Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is a special live broadcast from the 2017 Columbus Arts Festival in downtown Columbus. Art often is viewed as something hanging on a wall in a museum or displayed in a gallery with a price tag or gracing the wall of a private home. Public art is none of that. The best of public art is arresting and telling and perhaps controversial, because when is the last time the public agreed on much of anything? And public art is alive and well at the 2017 Columbus Arts Festival. Coming up, we'll talk with the artist behind the sculptural lighting installation erected yesterday for the festival this weekend. Joining us now is Malcolm Cochran. He is a distinguished visiting artist at Columbus College of Art and Design. He is a former professor of art at Ohio State and a former member of the Columbus Arts Commission. Several of his public works are familiar to Central Ohioans, including the Field of Corn in Dublin and the Goodale Park Fountain in Victorian Village. There are many other examples. Welcome to the show, Malcolm Cochran.
Thank you.
Also, Operations and Public Affairs Director for the Ohio Arts Council, Justin Nigro. Welcome.
Good morning, Ann.
Justin, why is public art important? Why a Ohio Arts Council?
I think there are a number of reasons that public art is important. First and foremost, I think it gives folks a sense of place, a sense of pride about their communities. A lot of the, I guess what you'd deem more successful public art installations really give cities, big cities, small towns, a sense of identity, a sense of pride, a sense of place. And you see that in a lot of the new works and new projects being commissioned that that folks commissioning new pieces are really hoping to attract that sensibility. Beyond that, though, there's an educational benefit to public art. I know that some of the pieces that we've worked on at the Ohio Arts Council have integrated arts education and college students when going about seeking community engagement for the pieces. So really, I think you can point to a lot of different reasons why public art is valued and valuable for the community.
Malcolm Cochran, what constitutes public art? Sometimes I think it's part of a building or, I don't know, a skyline almost in a way, but it's something more actually thought out.
Art. In 5 minutes or less?
Yes. My world and welcome to it.
Yeah. Well, I definitely agree with you that it can be in many places. The term that I think is most useful is something that is in the public realm, which means that it's not in a private space. And for me, what's also important on that is that it's something that you don't have to particularly seek out, but it's something that you come across. And whether that you see that on the side of a building, you might see it on a rooftop, you may see it from your car, you may experience it on the street. There are multiple ways you can experience it. It doesn't have to be big to be in the public realm. But
scale's often associated with it,
so
a larger scale. Yeah.
Well, but there are also some wonderful, very, very small projects that kind of catch you off guard and, uh-huh. and you know, little moments as you move through a city or a town that that I think are equally effective.
Yeah, I'm thinking of one of those examples I heard about recently in Kent, Ohio. They've got a traveling stanzas project through the Wick Poetry Center at Kent State University. And one of the elements, it's a multifaceted project, but one of the elements that they're doing is skinning basically electrical boxes mm-hmm. around the city of Kent with different poems that have been, you know, created through the program with a visual art aspect behind it, too.
I mean, they're covering up those good-looking electrical boxes.
Those ubiquitous electrical boxes that nobody, you know, you wouldn't give them a passing thought, but here you're taking something mundane and making it beautiful, and I think that there are a lot of small-scale projects like that that are really catching fire and taking hold.
Yeah. What's the difference, or is there any difference between graffiti and public art? So a graffiti being, that being a form of, I guess, vandalism in its way, but...
Yeah, it's a fine line between everything, right? Whether it's, you know, one person's art is another person's, you know, abhorrent thing to look at, but... with graffiti, there's an interesting intersection of that in public art. I think that opinions vary widely about whether, it should be taken down, kept up. Even when you think about other, iconic sculptures around the nation, around the world, some of them were unplanned, unorganized, and an artist just decided to you know, create a piece, put it here, and then have civic leaders in the community figure out what to do with it. Mm-hmm. So it's not just graffiti, but there are other, you know, guerrilla art, I think is what that's
okay.
what that's called. You know, you think of Banksy and you know, he comes to mind foremost, but not just him. There are plenty of examples you can think of where a community's left to think, okay, well, what do we do with this now? How do we preserve this? Do we even want this?
Right.
Yeah.
Malcolm Cochran?
Well, I think that for me, quality is always an issue. And I think there isn't one vocabulary for public art. So I would certainly say that something with the vocabulary of graffiti can be considered public art.
Mm-hmm.
But quality is important as well. So you have somebody like Banksy that really very thoughtful, smart works, and quality is what I look for. I can think of other projects where the vocabulary of graffiti has been used, for example, in a situation where an artist with some experience is working with high school kids, and they take an area that is like under a freeway overpass, let's say in LA.
Yeah.
And using that vocabulary, do things that are actually very provocative and very thoughtful. And that, for me, that's one of the layers that I think is critical. And I would apply that to all forms, you know, not just, this gets into a bigger topic here, but I think that public art, one of the things that public art suffers from is that it can fall into decoration. It can fall into being kind of baubles and you know, eye-catching eye candy. And I think eye candy, I think we can do more than eye candy with public art. In fact, that's a danger.
How did you get into public art? I mean, you've done some pretty big installations now. Obviously, you're pretty famous around here and for some of them. And is that something that you always wanted to do? Did you visualize yourself doing those kinds of projects like the Field of Corn? There's the gavel in front of the...
The gavel's not mine.
Oh, the gavel's not yours. Okay.
There's a text piece on the north side of which is not really visible unless you're walking by it.
I apologize.
That's okay.
But be that as it may, you know, those kinds of...
I did not set out to be a public artist. I think that careers develop organically. I was trained in ceramics, or my first work was in ceramics, and I went to graduate school in ceramics. And when I left that, I moved back to New Hampshire, which is where I'd grown up, and began working in other media at what I considered a kind of room size scale, kind of 12 by 12 by 12. And a curator in Buffalo, Nina Freudenheim, saw that work. And she said, have you ever thought about working in the public realm? And I had not. And there was a summer program called Art Park in Lewiston, New York, which is a wonderful program that had 10 or 12 artists doing temporary public projects each summer, and then they would come down. And that was my first foray into doing something in the landscape, and I liked it. And then, as many artists, I did maybe 6-8 temporary pieces. The idea that the pieces would look permanent was always important to me, so I think it was something I did at the Arts Festival of Atlanta, which is out of concrete, looked like it could have been there forever, and it was up for 10 days.
Uh-huh.
But you build a track record through the temporary projects to be able to then apply for permanent projects.
What about your work made her ask you if you'd ever thought about working in the public realm?
I think it was mostly the scale of it, that it was sort of certainly worked in a gallery scale, but that by being in Buffalo, she was very well aware.
12 by 12, you're talking about 12 feet by 12 feet?
Yeah.
Okay.
Sort of room size construction.
Okay,
yeah.
I gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And I never worked on the pedestal. For me, sculpture is always on the floor in our space, just the way this table is in our space and these chairs. And so being outdoors was the next step.
I'm from Grand Rapids, Michigan, and remember very well the decision to spend a lot of money at the time on a very large sculpture by Alexander Calder. I've always loved it from the very beginning. I was in, I think, junior high at the time. But apparently I was in a minority back then. It was in the 1970s. Now it is a beloved landmark. It's the Calder Plaza, and everybody loves it. How, you know, Justin Nigro, is that like the, you know, the epitome of what you're shooting for? You know, I mean, it was very controversial at the time, but I'm not sure how much they spent. It would not seem like that much today, but at the time it was a lot.
Sure.
Of course, Calder's fantastic.
Calder's, you know, world-renowned.
He's it.
I think at the onset of public art projects, it's very important to have a sense for what the goals of the project are. What does success really look like?
Yeah,
I think sometimes there's this preconceived notion that, you know, public art is a cure-all. It's gonna make put our city on the map for sure. Unquestionably, people will know us for this. And then sometimes those if those expectations aren't managed, the project can really feel deflated at the end if it doesn't totally transform a community. So being, I think, realistic about what public art is and what it does is important. Now that said, I think when citizens, when the public walks past a piece of public art, you know, what makes pieces successful? Well, do they start conversations? Are they engaging? Are they relatable? Are they attention grabbing is the wrong word, but, you know, do they pique your curiosity? Do they make you linger and think for a moment? Are there layers of meaning behind it? And one piece doesn't have to do all those things, but something. I think that's what, you know, when you're passing by a piece of work, maybe those pieces tend to be viewed with more success. I think it's a common experience for artists that work is initially looked at, the community reacts somewhat negatively, and then over the course of time, like with the piece in Grand Rapids, they come to warm to it. And you know, this is everything from the Eiffel Tower to the...
And by the way, that's where they have their art festival every year, is down by the Calder Plaza. You know, it's like I said, it's iconic now.
Yeah, and the Art Prize, I think, was there last year.
Art Prize has been there several years.
Yeah,
it's really interesting.
Yeah, it's a huge
competition.
Huge commission and a huge award.
Yeah. So I'm checking on... Okay, let's take a break right now. We'll continue our conversation with Malcolm Cochran. He's an artist, sculptor, and distinguished visiting artist at the Columbus College of Art and Design. Also, Justin Nigro, he's Operations and Public Affairs Director for the Ohio Arts Council. We're talking about public art today. Coming up, we're going to hear from the artists who have erected a temporary piece right here at the Arts Festival. We are broadcasting live from the 2017 Columbus Arts Festival in downtown Columbus. The WOSU booth is located near the intersection of Civic Center and Cherry Street, or 2nd and Cherry, depending on your perspective. Drop by, say hi, come on down to the festival. It's perfect out here. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. This is a special live broadcast from the 2017 Columbus Arts Festival in downtown Columbus. We're talking about art in public places, how it is commissioned, designed, and executed. Still with us is the Operations and Public Affairs Director for the Ohio Arts Council, Justin Nigro. The council commissions and funds public artworks through its Percent for Art program. And Justin, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us, artist and sculptor, distinguished visiting artist at the Columbus College of Art and Design, Malcolm Cochran. Thanks again, Malcolm.
Thanks for having me.
Let's get back to that issue of when, you know, the whole idea of public art, and what if everybody doesn't agree that it's important or matters or what it looks like, don't like what it looks like.
Well, I can tell you a story about the field of corn in Dublin, which I think is and this is building on the talk about the Calder piece not being popular in Grand Rapids at first, and it's now the icon of the city that's on their garbage trucks and the thing.
Right, exactly. And it's on all of their signposts, all their street signs.
And Justin mentioned the Eiffel Tower, which was, you know, considered an eyesore when it was built, and now who doesn't go to Paris to see the Eiffel Tower?
Well, it's the iconic symbol of Paris. Yeah.
So I was on a teaching exchange in Holland when my proposal was selected for Dublin, and this is pre-internet, pre-email, right. And so we got a fax of the front page of the Dispatch, and this is paraphrasing; it's not quite right, but it's something like "Field of Corn to set Dublin on its ear." And I got a call from the then director of the Dublin Arts Council and said, "What do we do?" You know. And the big complaint was, one of the complaints was, you know, couldn't we have had a playground? You know, what about for the kids? What are we going to do? You know, well, conditions of the competition was that they saw it as a place that would have drive-by potential, that would not be a park where you would stop and get off. So that's one of the things that I thought about. But I said, basically, you know, I can't do anything from here, but when I come back from Holland, I will be glad to make a presentation about it. And I began doing some research, and this was an odd circumstances, because it was researching after the fact to try to justify why I would put ears of corn in that location.
And big ears of corn. Yeah.
Right. Large-scale figures.
Just for people humans, who aren't familiar
humans,
with it.
Human-sized ears of corn without the husks.
Right.
I went through a number of things. Just my gut had told me that had been a farming. It's on the river. Yeah. It's very fertile land, you know. But what really cinched it for me is that I was able to get a photograph through a local historian who was in touch with the woman, Eulalia France, who used to live there. Their farm was torn down. That's why it's France Road. And it had a photograph of cornfield with paper bags over the ears so that they could control pollination. And Sam France was working with the OSU Extension on that. And I thought, this really nails it. You know, so I made this presentation. But still, it was not popular. Now, this, just to rewind a little bit, because things changed very fast in the last 24 years, Tuttle Mall did not exist at that point. Right. There were stakes where the road would be, and this was just, you know, all in the, quote, development. Well, that was 94. About 2000, one of my students came in at OSU and said, "Have you seen this brochure from Tuttle Mall?" I said, "No, I don't shop at Tuttle Mall." Well, it was their spring brochure for the whole mall, and the background photos were all a field of corn. And I thought, boy, this is amazing that within the space of 6 to 8 years, you have something being used as a marketing tool. Now I have a collection of photographs people send me. "Hey, did you see this at Trader Joe's? Over the produce stand, somebody did a chalk drawing of the field of corn." Trader Joe's on fun, you know. And it's remarkable to see that transformation.
I had friends who did their Christmas card there every year.
Well, yeah, and then back to this point about what can the kids do? Well, on the dedication, kids were running around, hiding behind them, playing frisbees around them. Kids get it.
Yeah.
Kids are a really good index. Now, I say that because I think, again, to expand on what Justin said, I think that it's that probably the best public works are controversial to begin with. If they're universally loved to start with, then it's something that's really familiar. And you think about that in terms of music, think about it in terms of literature. But people, the initial reaction to things we're not familiar with is that we don't understand them, or expands to we don't like them. And it takes exposure and thinking. And I think that can happen in the public realm as well as any other art form.
Well, and Malcolm, you know what I think is interesting about your piece, too, is that it invokes a sense of heritage and history, right? The concrete corn and the field of corn. And as that part of Franklin County has developed so much over the course of the years, it almost becomes even more important. And your piece almost says something different in a way. You know, it's really bringing the modern to what used to be farmland. And it reminds me, too, of the pieces by Terry Allen, now Scioto Lounge, the deer that have been installed here and are becoming increasingly popular. People turn, they look, they go, what's that?
You mean like the one on the bridge?
The one on the bridge, right? The deer on the bridge or over here in the lawn.
Wonderful project.
Yeah, very interesting project. And again, it calls this, it calls your heritage into question, your history. You know, I learned recently because of that series of pieces that, you know, Scioto stands for Hairy River, because tufts of deer hair, you know, would collect along the riverbanks. And
when they were shedding.
They were shedding, yeah. And so it gives your, you know, your geography a better sense of, folks learn about their geography a little bit more through that and their place and time. It's fascinating.
We're talking about public art. What do you think? Give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Tell us what you think about public art. Have you been pleased, pained, whatever it might be? My guests are Malcolm Cochran. He's an art sculptor and distinguished visiting artist at the Columbus College of Art and Design. Also, you just heard from Justin Nigro. He's the Operations and Public Affairs Director for the Ohio Arts Council. What is it like to receive a commission for art? How does that... let's talk about Justin Nigro from where you sit, mm-hmm. how it starts, what the process involves, and then Malcolm, you know, pick it up from where you receive the commission, how you apply for it, and that kind of a thing.
Be happy to. I'll say a little bit about the States Percent for Art program, which began in 1990. There was a wave of programs happening at the time across the nation, and now we're one of 28 states that has a Percent for Art program. Our program is really centered around the state passing a capital budget. So when the state spends $4 million or more on a specific capital project at a state agency, then that triggers the Percent for Art requirement that 1% of those funds have to be dedicated toward commission of or purchase of and installation of a public artwork. And so as the program's grown over time, you see a lot of our pieces at college campuses, universities, public universities around the state.
Because that's where they're spending so much stinking money.
Lots of renovation work, right? Lots of renovation and building work. It dominates capital budget.
Yeah,
so you'll see them there. So the process starts for us with, for instance, most of these colleges and universities, but even the non-college projects have committees, which takes, you know, involve community members. And they will look at various components, the budget, the site requirements, even a theme, especially on college campuses. Sometimes there's a theme that they'd like to tie the public art into, for instance, if you're working around a math building, for instance.
Uh-huh.
And they'll look at all those components, and then our agency will issue either an open call, which we publicize on our website and through our artist email distribution lists, that there's a call for art, you know, here are the specifications, and then those will go to the committee. They'll narrow that down usually to a top three and go from there.
How do you decide the specs on something like that?
So much of it is really site-specific,
so
right?
So we've got this space to fill or
right.
Whatever.
Yeah, whether it's, you know, and again, that it's not always outdoors, right? Some of these pieces are indoors. We're looking at, you know, paintings in that case. Maybe the budget, you know, is such that... existing artwork would be easier to purchase than a totally new work. So it really varies depending on the size of the project and what the committee and what the community are looking to achieve through it.
And Malcolm, what's it like to apply for that?
Well, it really depends on your level of experience. And for me, the best situation is where it's an invitation to make a proposal.
Uh-huh.
And they could say, well, we've narrowed it down. We've seen your work. Based on previous work, we would like you to make a proposal, and you and three others. And that's one of the best ways to go into it, as opposed to a completely open call. The other thing that I think is really critical to getting a good piece, and a lot of places that want public art don't understand this because they're novices, that they might send you photographs of the site and a plan of it and a description of what they're looking for, and they want you to make a proposal. But there's no money to come visit the site. There's no money to come meet the people. There's no money to come see things.
Yeah.
And for me, it's absolutely critical. I go into... my works don't look the same. I don't have anything that comes off the shelf. So I learned a number of years ago to trust that when I got to a site, an idea would materialize. So Field of Corn looks nothing like the text up here by the Judicial Center.
Right.
Those are absolutely site-specific pieces, and that's important to me. And I would never do a Field of Corn anywhere else. I've been asked. I wouldn't do it. So for me, going to the site and figuring it out is important. Then, of course, you've got the budget question. And so your proposal, from the artist's point of view, we have to do a lot of work up front because they're going to want to say, well, this is a great idea, but can we build it for that? So in a way, you have to do your calculations with fabricators. You have to think about installation costs. You have to think about labor. You have to think about materials.
Yeah.
All of that. For most of my projects, I'm embarrassed to say, even until recently, I would put my honorarium back into the project. So I would essentially make
your profit. I guess
you're right. There would be no profit, basically, that it would go into it. And I just say it's important to have the work there, you know, and which is one of the reasons that I taught for 27 years at OSU, you know, because I had that income to cover basic expenses.
Yeah.
In terms of site, and Justin mentioned this, I think one of the things that is important for people commissioning is to really trust the artist and have it be as open as possible, as opposed to saying, we have this spot, we have a circle in the middle of this plaza, we really like to have a statue there. A lot of people use statue as what a public art is, right? When we organized, or I led the project called Finding Time, Columbus Public Art 2012, our site was the downtown special improvement district. And we had artists coming in from out of town and local artists. And we said, we walked the site, said, you can look anywhere here. This would be the same thing with Terry Allen for the works on the bridge. We didn't say, we want something for the bridge, or we want something for the river. We want something downtown.
Uh-huh.
You bring the artist here with that completely open, that allows the imagination to be open. And then the artist says, boy, I know you told me that you want something where that Kroger trash bin is right there, but if we moved it over to the sidewalk where those guys are sitting, I think you'd have X, Y, and Z instead. And then you're really you're getting the benefit of an artist's eyes on things, which is what we bring to it as well as whatever our form is. So,
Justin, I grow, is that a familiar give and take?
I think like any project, you come in with an initial thought, and then there are adjustments throughout the planning process that really reveal what else is possible or what could be possible if we thought about things differently. So I think that that creative evolution is really critical and oftentimes improves the end result.
You know, the latest most famous statue in New York City depicts a girl. It's entitled Fearless Girl, and it faces off with a charging bull sculpture near Wall Street at the foot of Broadway. Not everyone loves it. That includes the sculptor behind the charging bull. Behind Charging Bull, I should say, the isn't part of the title. They say it was never intended to represent the possible trampling death of a small child. I read that in The Guardian. I've never viewed the juxtaposition of the two sculptures as such a scenario. It's so funny that somebody has that point of view. I've always just seen it as a really interesting juxtaposition. But be that as it may, Malcolm Cochran, what about that? So there's the deer on the bridge. What if somebody else installed something else that changes the perspective of that public art, or somebody builds something, or something changes externally? How do you feel about that?
Well, that particular example on Wall Street is, and I've been following the news of it, it's an unusual situation. I think that once the works are in the public, they do have a life of their own. At the same time, I think one of the suggestions is that girl be there temporarily and then it move. And so I think something that that comments on something existing, you acknowledge this is the primary object or the primary work in this situation here, and we can have things that comment on it. And then I think that can be really lively and very interesting. But if it becomes competitive, don't know that it is fair to the original artist.
Yeah.
That things would be Yeah, I wouldn't want to see another tower next to the Eiffel Tower.
Yeah, right.
Yeah,
you know? Right.
But something small or something temporary next to it could be very funny. You know, could be. There's this wonderful project in London called the fourth plinth. There are four plinths. I can't remember the name of the square, but three out of four identical plinths have classical statuary on them. The fourth one was never finished. And each year they commission a new work for that plinth.
Uh-huh.
So it's part of the set. It can be integrated to it. It can comment on it. It can be radically different. They often are. To me, that's terrific, you know, that you're playing with something and you build that into a program. But they're all temporary.
Boy, what you said really resonates. Just the fact that art takes on a life of its own once it's out in the public sphere. I always think of the literary arts because our authors will put symbology in their works and this symbol means this, but then it's really open to interpretation.
Or they didn't mean anything like that.
At all. And then all of a sudden you're assigning meaning and value to it.
Right.
And just to coming back to Charging Bull, one of the things I learned through the coverage of the Fearless Girl and the original artist behind Charging Bull is that Arturo Demotica, he's the Charging Bull artist. Mm-hmm. That was guerrilla art. So he created that and just kind of plunked it.
That's right.
On Christmas, I think it was either Christmas Eve or Christmas Day in New York City. And the city, you know, it was controversial immediately. Everybody said, what are we going to do with this piece? We don't want this piece. There was this aversion to it, like we've been talking about this hour. And now it is an iconic piece. So he was the guerrilla artist. And now you've got the artist of Fearless Girl, Kristen Visbol, I think her name is. And her piece was actually planned to some extent in honor of, I think it was International Women's Day, to be there. And then the city extended the permit for it to stay there. But there's this aversion to it, right? Or there's this defense of it.
Yeah.
So it's really an interesting case study on what public art does. And I understand I have sympathy for both artists in the situation, whereas one is bringing a new meaning to another's work, but the original artist isn't happy with that meaning.
In Minneapolis, there's been a big controversy over an art piece that was going up in the city sculpture garden. It's entitled Scaffold. The piece is a composite of seven different events in U.S. history involving capital punishment. And one depicts the 1862 Mankato massacre in which 38 men from the Dakota tribe were executed. Backers were shocked. Backers of the art installation were shocked at the outcry over the piece. And it made me wonder kind of what sort of vetting does go on to get by in, or at least to become aware of the potential backlash for the likes of something like this. Justin?
That's interesting. I hadn't heard of that particular case. I do know in the past we've had works that have certainly had artistic limitations to them because of their setting. So, and the best example I can think of this is at the North Coast Behavioral Health Center in Northfield, Ohio, which is it's a mental hospital, for lack of a better term. And in that case, the artist, Susan Danko of Parma, had to work within certain confines, you know, color, everything from color to, you know, what mood does the piece invoke. There was even interest in having some wayfinding incorporated into the pieces because you're working with, you know, folks who have behavioral health disorders and are seeking assistance. So in that case, the community there that was involved, the committee there that was involved, involved everybody from doctors on staff, a patient advocate, the original architect of the building, the artist, and she, you know, gracefully threaded that needle to still maintain, you know, at least some level of creative license while working within the limitations of that project. That's the easiest example I can think of works that we've been a part of in the past, but certainly there is that tension sometimes between a public art or artwork that's in finest, at least in part by public tax dollars, and you know, where can I go with this? And Malcolm, you probably know that world much better than I do too, as the artist here.
Yeah, and again, that's that balance of what do you, if you're only going to put out something that is immediately popular and that everybody loves, to me, it's going to be in some way watered down. Or ultimately forgettable. And I don't think we should be putting our culture dollars in things that are forgettable.
Okay, Malcolm Cochran, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Malcolm Cochran is an artist, sculptor, and distinguished visiting artist at the Columbus College of Art and Design, and also Justin Nigro, Operations and Public Affairs Director for the Ohio Arts Council. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Anne, and I hope everyone comes down to the Columbus Arts Festival here over the course of the weekend.
We're broadcasting live from the 2017 Columbus Arts Festival in downtown Columbus. The WOSU booth will be here all weekend, so drop by. I'm only going to be here for a little while longer, but I'm going to be hanging out at the booth for the rest of the most of the afternoon. We're right down at, Civic Center in Cherry or 2nd, depending on where you're coming from, down by the Bicentennial Park. For more information about the festival, check out the link on our website at WOSU.org/AllSides. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. This is a special live broadcast from the site of the 2017 Columbus Arts Festival in downtown Columbus. We're talking about public art. We've been talking about how public art is curated, planned, funded. Now we turn to the creators of a piece commissioned for the festival this year. It is entitled Structural Circumstances, EG2, the numeral 2. It is a 24-foot-long representation of a mobile home using colored, transparent plexiglass. Joining us is artist and Ohio native Samuel Wagner. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Also joining us is artist, you're from Tokyo, you grew up in Tokyo?
Hong Kong,
okay. Mm-hmm. Christabel Wagner, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
But you're from New Zealand, you were born there.
Yes, correct.
Right, okay. How did this structure, you worked together on this, and I want to get to that in a second, that whole process, but how did this structure occur to you, Samuel?
Well, I had worked on a previous project when I was studying for my master's in London. I had taken some time and went to Spain to work in this small town. And in this small town, they had a castle that was there, and the interior of the castle had been stripped away and taken to the Met. So that castle's interior is at the Met. And they wanted us to create some kind of work around that small town, maybe drive tourism there, see a reaction to it. So I had a very rudimentary composite of what it would look like. And it looks kind of like what we have here. So it's made of very colorful acetate. It looks like the castle. And it was planned to be kind of plopped down on an adjacent hill. So these two structures would kind of play off of each other, uh-huh. And depending on whether people wanted to come see reality or the fictional. So kind of play with that.
Okay. And Christabel, what about it? This is something to have to do specifically with Ohio and rural life.
Correct. So basically, we came up with this idea from the original Spain example. And we knew that idea wasn't fully developed. And while we were driving around Ohio, since we've moved back about a year ago, we found out about this competition. We really thought, this is the time where we can really develop this idea. And while driving around Ohio, we pass a lot of trailer homes, like mobile homes, and that's my idea sparked immediately. You know, this is what we can do to drive traffic and bring about a culture that's very much forgotten.
Yeah, it's on so many levels. It really worked for me. It's very arresting, and it's this look inside of something a lot of people just drive by.
Mm-hmm.
And what do you want them to see?
I think there's a lot going on there. Mm-hmm. I think the most important thing is enjoyment and fun. I want people to be truly absorbed in the experience and just enjoy it. Because I think no matter whether you are poor or not, there's still joy in your life. I think that's something that a lot of people gets lost in translation. They think poverty just means desperate and unhappy. I think that there's something to the joy that this can bring.
And from my outside point of view is that I didn't grow up in America. I grew up in New Zealand, in Hong Kong. I had a very vibrant urban life. And having moved to America and seeing where he grew up, it's a complete contrast from what I understand. But at the same time, I felt very comfortable getting to know the different structures of how people live. I would say during the current global climate, you can say it's a conversation that everyone's having right now. And I think this piece has that same conversation, but from our very personal experience as well. We don't want to make a statement. I don't think we are wise enough or have enough experience to ever give an answer to the current climate. However, we do want to have a conversation. We want to spark questions for people when they look at the piece. Like, why did we make a mobile home? Why did we pick that culture? And that's what we're trying to do.
It's always surprising when I meet people who have never been to Southeast Ohio. It's like a different world. There's a lot of poverty, of course. Appalachia is, known for that, but it's also incredibly beautiful. And it's just surprising how little people get out. They drive through
Absolutely.
It, but they don't get out of their cars.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I grew up next to Marietta, Ohio. And Marietta is, it's a gem. It's
exactly.
really beautiful. I mean, the New York Times, they pretty regularly will write about it and it, come visit Marietta. So that's a real great acclaim to be in the New York Times for such a small town that's in, just ignored for a good part of the state and country.
So you're married to each other. You met at the Chelsea College of Art and Design in London, where you both earned a master's degree.
Mm-hmm.
But this is the first project you've worked on together, and I thought that was kind of interesting. It's going to be public. You're going to talk about it publicly. What's it like, Cristobal, to work on something like that together?
It's been challenging, but in a good way. I think it's fair to say that we've always meddled in each other's work since we've met each other.
Yeah.
But I think our practice is so different and so opposite. We really do benefit from each other's critics. And just, with this project, Sam wouldn't be able to kind of come to this full idea without my outside point of view. And then even with my own practice, he gives a lot of criticism to it as well, which I wouldn't get without him.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, I just think that Cristobal offers, I have a lot of technical knowledge, working with the material and building the things, but you always get to some point where it's kind of breaking point, and you need another level head to really get you through it, and Cristobal is crucial to this. I mean, this is, it's 50% me and 50% Cristobal, if not more Cristobal.
Do you both usually do public art types of pieces, or tell me a little bit about what you're usually doing?
Yeah. So my work is generally relatively close to what you see here. It's
okay.
Generally large scale. There's this project, I want to reconstruct mountaintops that have been leveled through coal mining, so pretty grand scale things. That's what I usually do.
Now in the past year, we've been working on the tank project as well, which uses public structures that's already in place, and then we're adding fun pinatas onto it where we invite children to break the pinata. So I think we've been playing around with the public art for about a year. I think since with this piece, I would say it's the tip of an iceberg of what we are trying to do. We are definitely going to be doing more public works. We want to have more of a conversation, not just only about poverty, but also about different class structures. And this is why this piece is called Structural Circumstances Example 2, just because there is so many different structural circumstances that one is born into that has a different conversations versus another.
Mm-hmm.
Stephen in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Stephen.
Hello there. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Excellent. So I had a couple of observations I wanted to add that build upon the previous conversation that you were having with Malcolm and your other guest. And one is in relation to the way public art is initiated through agencies, through public entities. And as Malcolm, I believe, said, and I didn't hear the whole conversation, but at least alluded to, is that a community, a commissioning entity, gets the best return when they call for qualifications. and not proposals, because two facets of that. One aspect of that is that it's expected then that the artist will fund themselves the proposal. In other words, come up with a concept, do all the work it takes to get that concept ready for submission at their own expense, as opposed to a more sophisticated entity, agency, spending the time to review the work so that they then select, review the artists based on their work, so that they then select the best artists whom they think are qualified for that project, and then empower them, enable them to take the time that it really takes to develop a concept in a way that relates to the site, which leads me to the second piece of my thinking, and that is that work that is engendered, inspired by the site, some people call it site-specific work, is, I believe, the most successful. Work that's drawn from the history, as Malcolm did with his field of corn, work that's drawn and inspired by the site and its usage, the people who are going to be coming to it, I think, have a greater sense of place. And
okay, well, let's see. Let's...
...to place and to each other is the most successful in the public arena.
Okay. Stephen, thank you.
Yeah. If I could kind of point out part of his argument, it's incredibly important for... people to give an opportunity, an open call to artists, because young artists are not going to be considered otherwise. We would not have gotten this prize if we had not thrown our hat into the ring. So it's fine to continually perpetuate experienced artists in that realm, but look, we needed a shot too. We needed an opportunity, and we were lucky enough, and yeah, it came out of our pocket, but that's what we were already doing anyway, you know?
Yeah.
So I think that he has valid points, but it's important that we have young artists come in through the open proposal process.
Right, right. It was a $25,000 fee awarded, or whatever you call it, honorarium, I'm not sure. Did it cover the costs?
It did, yes. Okay, it covered the costs.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. All right. What about it? This is a temporary installation.
Mm-hmm.
Where's it going to go? What do you do with it?
Well, we were just speaking with a member, the president of the GCAC, and he was just telling us that there was some interest from another light festival. So we'll just kind of see where that takes it. Otherwise, I don't know.
Yeah, we'll play as it goes, but we're going to continue working no matter what. This is, you know, part of what we do. And, you know, for us, we're artists, and we need it as part of our life. And we're very appreciative that GCAC had this competition, because it allows a lot of emerging artists to put their hat in the ring, as well as just get their name out there, because you don't really get that opportunity. You see all these experienced artists out there doing the public work, and this is a great opportunity for all the artists who are studying at CCAD, OSU, to get this opportunity.
Congratulations. I have not said that yet. Congratulations on it. You can see the piece. It is entitled, let's see. Nope. Why don't you tell me what it's entitled? I don't have it written down here
easily. Yeah, it says Structural Circumstances Example 2.
Okay. It says EG2.
Oh, that's just, I guess, the proper English way of breaking down example.
All right, there
Google,
you go.
Google told me so I believe it.
All right, Samuel Wagner, artist and Ohio native. Christabel Wagner, artist and New Zealand native, married. It's also a light installation. It's something that's different at night, so check it out here at the Columbus Arts Festival. Thanks to Eric French and Kevin Petrilla for helping us work this out. Radio Operations Director Kevin Petrilla, Senior Broadcast Technician Eric French, Producer Michael DeBonis, Assistant Producer Shia Lanott, All Sites Interns Kelly Rudolph, Kyle McKinnon, Aaron Kinkley, and Owen Doherty, with video production by Rich Blue and Amber Blue. Be sure to like All Sides on Facebook and follow the show on Twitter at WOSU All Sides. Coming up on 89.7 Fresh Air with Terry Gross, I'll be handing off this live broadcast from the Columbus Arts Festival to Jennifer Hambrick for Classical 101. So if you want to stay with the live broadcast, you can catch us here. And as a matter of fact, I'll be Jennifer's first guest. They'll be kicking off the music portion of the broadcast with my request for some Sousa marches. So thanks a lot for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.